Good evening, and thank you for coming. We continue our study on the land. Today's lesson number 38 in the series is entitled Immigration and Riots. This is talking about the riots that occurred in Israel or Palestine in the beginning of the Jewish or British mandated period of about 1920. On December 8, 1941, Franklin Delano Roosevelt said that December 7 was to live in infamy. It was the day that Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, an attack on United States soil, and the isolationist country entered World War II. Roosevelt did not live to see May 15, 1948, only a few years later, but had he could have added another day with even more infamy. The Arabs call it Nakba, the Day of Disgrace. The Jews call it Independence Day, and the Bible-believing Christians call it Fulfilled Prophecy, the first of such historical events for nearly 2,000 years. Think about that. That's really quite incredible. There really is no biblical event that is a Fulfilled Prophecy event since the 70 AD destruction of Jerusalem. So for those of us that were alive during this time, it's really quite remarkable. Thus, the establishment of Israel in the land is the most remarkable event in the Christian era. To be sure, the long-anticipated restoration to the land is not without trouble for the people of Israel, as we will see. The Jews have had a duty and a privilege unparalleled in human history to communicate through the prophets and the writers of the Bible, the Word of God to the world. This has been characterized often as the burden of God. To be his messengers, as a prophet can attest, is lonely office, often a lonely office filled with dangers and many misgivings. Historically, it's been difficult for Israel to be faithful to her task. They have easily followed other gods and attempted to shake off the idea of God at all, as in modern-day atheism. But God is not so fickle as to let the chosen out of their responsibility. After judgment, the favor of God will return in installments to the Jewish people to fulfill their task in the divine kingdom, which is what we anticipate with the return of the Lord. Our studies are looking at the means or mechanisms that God has used or is utilizing to bring his people into the land and to a state of obedience. We find them there are at this point not in a state of obedience, but as I said, God is doing this in installments. And this follows the pattern of Ezekiel 37, 38, and 39. To grasp the phenomenal realities of the land in the 18th, 19th century, considering the following: the Bible puts the city of Jerusalem in the center of the world again. An old map shows Israel, Jerusalem in the center of the world, where two leaves that form a plant. Each one of them represents one of the sons of Noah. And then on the right we see a picture of the city of David, or the original Zion, that is in ruins, apparently, and in the far distance, we see Mount Scopus, and to the right of the picture, we'll find the parts of the Mount of Olives and the original, or should say the Ottoman walls of Jerusalem around 1517, approximately 1530, in that period of time when Suleiman the Magnificent built them. The Kidron Valley is on the right. The Tyropene Valley, barely a depression now, used to be much deeper and has been filled in over the years. So what was once a center of the world became a backwater place will again become the center of the world. In order for a city to thrive, there must be some commercial, economic, or safety issue, like at Megiddo, to give it a reason for its prosperity. Jerusalem was important as a pilgrimage city in the Crusader years, 1080 to 1300. But with the Islamic conquest from 700 on, Constantinople, we call it now Istanbul, in 1553, Jerusalem and the land of Israel fell into insignificance. Jerusalem had little going for it by the 19th century. The Suez Canal, completed in 1869, opened the sea lanes to the east by bypassing the land. The ancient world, the Levant land bridge, was important in the world commerce, but now it was more like an abandoned bridge connecting the Ottoman Empire or Ottoman territories, which led to a nowheresville. So a couple of pictures that are from the last part of the 19th century in Galilee during the 19th century, around 1850. It shows that there really was no real value to the land, and the nations acted accordingly and ignored it, and so did its people. So we have a picture of a desolate land, which is descriptive of the way the Bible describes it. Magdala, the place where Mary Magdalene came from, now has been excavated, as you can see on the right. Before it was excavated, now it is a spot that is on the westernmost corner of the heart-shaped Sea of Galilee. And you look into the distance, you see the mountain rise up with a little hump on the right. We see that same figure on the modern picture, although the modern picture has a different lens, so therefore it makes the mountain seem higher. Anyway, we see a desolate land. We see a land of no buildings, no development, and even what we see in the foreground in Magdala is still a ruin, and there are some people at the bottom of the picture, as you can see, characteristic of the land. Now, Isaiah chapter 1, it begins in verse 7, as the land is desolate, and your cities are burned with fire, your fields, strangers are devouring them in your presence. It is desolation and overthrown by strangers. The daughter of Zion is left like a shelter in the vineyard, while the watchman's hut in a cucumber field like a besieged city. So Israel has been reduced to just a hut in an abandoned field compared to the magnificence of a city like Jerusalem. Unless the Lord the host had left us a few survivors, we would be like Sodom and would be like Gomorrah. And one of the New Testament writers refers to this passage, and there it is referring to the Jews that are within the church. So God has continued to save a few Jews in the time of the desolation of the land. Alas, for the day is great. This is talking about the tribulation that is still future. There is none like it, and it is the time of Jacob's distress, but he will be saved from it. It shall come about on that day, declares the Lord of hosts, that I will break the yoke from off the neck and will tear off their bonds, and the strangers will no longer make them their slaves, all a promise of the future. But they shall serve the Lord their God and David their king, whom I will raise up. Fear not, O Jacob, my servant, declares the Lord, I will not be dismayed, O Israel, for behold, I will save you from afar, and your offspring from the land of their captivity. And Jacob will return and will be quiet and at ease, and no one will make him afraid. So we see the cycling. With one hand, God offers judgment. On the other hand, he offers peace. For I am with you, declares the Lord, to save you. For I will destroy completely all the nations where I have scattered you. Only I will not destroy you completely, again, leaving that remnant. But I have chastened you justly, and will by no means leave you unpunished. For thus says Lord your God, your wound is incurable, and your injury is serious. We always have this play between the immediate context of the generation that he's talking to, and then the generation that is to come. So the immediate generation is incurable, their injury is serious, but then there is yet a recovery later. All of your lovers have forgotten you. They do not seek you. For I have wounded you with the wound of an enemy, with the punishment of a cruel one, because your iniquity is great and your sins are numerous. Why do you cry out over your iniquity? Your pain is incurable. Again, speaking to the immediate generation. Because your iniquity is great, your sins are numerous, I have done these things to you. Therefore, all who devour you will be devoured, and your adversaries, every one of them, will go into captivity. And those who plunder you will be for plunder, and those who prey upon you I will give for prey. For I will restore you to health, and I will heal you of your wounds, says the Lord your God, speaking of the distant generation, because they have called you an outcast, saying, it's Zion, and no one cares for it. And that little last phrase has been the characteristic of the land of Zion for nearly 2,000 years. It is Zion, and no one cares for her. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will restore the fortunes of the tents of Jacob, and have compassion on his dwelling places, and the city will be rebuilt on its ruin, and the palace will stand in its rightful place. Interesting remark about the palace being standing in the rightful place. They are now digging and think they have discovered the place where David's palace stood, and it certainly would have been next to the temple, which is not in the place where the temple is usually considered, on the Temple Mount. It's in the city of David down the hill in the picture I showed you in the ruined spots. From them will proceed thanksgiving and the voice of those who celebrate. And I will multiply them, and they will not be diminished. I will also honor them, and they will not be insignificant. So we have this promise of a restoration. But in the meantime, the land lies desolate, and it is not cared for by the nations. It is not loved for by the people, and it looks like it's abandoned by the Lord. With the advent of Zionism and its quest for a homeland for the Jews in these forgotten backwaters, or this back deserts, the land somehow becomes the most important place in the world, where the most significant people will live. One would think that gold was discovered in them. There are hills or huge fields of crude oil gushing out of the ground, but none of this. It was, in fact, a wasteland stripped of all trees and vegetation, vacant of people, even wild beasts, even the deer became extinct in the land. But it was not always, even under the Christian era, when there was a little attention given to the land. Fields of grain had once covered the plains. This is talking about the Negev, the southern part of Israel. And even the Negev had supported in Byzantine times six towns with 5,000 and 10,000 population, with many smaller settlements in between. So at one time, it was, the land has the ability to sustain life. The country was not under a curse, according to archaeological observation. It had reverted to the nomad and gone to decay for a simple reason: lack of cultivation. When the people disappeared, the land went back to its forlorn state. The Arab conquest had swept out the last of the Byzantine Christian civilization as locust swarm devastates a cornfield, leaving the land to Bedouins and goats. Just a reminder, disregard for the land. It was a land without people, and really a people without the land, as some have said. The people that had visited the land were impressed by the few people. Mark Twain mentioned that in one of his descriptions. In an excursion, they did not see one person. The observation is important because of what some have made of Wilson's 14 points, that the indigenous people were to be consulted about their governance. This is under the settlement at Versailles after World War I. As we said earlier, there never was such an inquiry of any people, even where there was a densely populated region. No reason to consult. There were no people to consult. Dia Cassilius, an earlier person, 155-235, described the ruin of the land, beginning with the destruction of Judah. Of their forts, 50 strongest were razed to the ground, 985 of their best-known villages were destroyed. Thus the whole of Judea became desert, as indeed had been foretold to the Jews before the war, which would be 70 AD. For the tomb of Solomon, whom these folks celebrate in their sacred rites, fell of its own accord into fragments, and wolves and hyenas, many in number, roamed howling through their cities. In the 12.5 centuries between the Arab conquest and the 7 centuries, in the beginning of the Jewish return in the 1880s, Palestine was laid waste. Its ancient canals, irrigation system was destroyed, and the wondrous fertility of which the Bible speaks vanished into the desert and in desolation. Under the Ottoman Empire of the Turks, the policy of defoliation continued. The hillsides were denuded of trees, and valleys were robbed of their topsoil. David Landis says, as a result of centuries of Turkish neglect and misrule following on the earlier ravages of successive conquerors, the land had been given over to sand, marsh, to the mosquito, clan feuds, Bedouin marauders. The population of several million had shrunk to less than one-tenth of that number, perhaps to a quarter of a million, around 1,800 and 300,000 at mid-century. Palestine had indeed become a sackcloth of ashes. Now, let me make a comment about the numbers. It's very, very difficult to find the numbers of the people that were in the land at this time, especially when it comes to the Arab number, because there really never was any count of the Arabs, especially on immigration. There was some count of Jewish people, but so you will find some conflicting numbers even in my presentation, because I cite different sources. In 1580, an English visitor to Jerusalem, this would be after Solomon rebuilt the walls, which were rebuilt somewhere around the time of the Reformation, 1517. In 1590, 60 years later, a simple English visitor to Jerusalem wrote, "Nothing there to be seen but a little of the old walls which is yet remaining. All the rest is grass, moss, weeds, much like a piece of bark on moist ground." In the mid-1700, British archaeologist Thomas Shaw wrote that the land in Palestine was lacking in people to till the fertile soil. An 18th century French author and historian, Count Constantine Francisco Valnay, wrote of Palestine as the ruined and desolate land. The British Council in Palestine reported in 1857 that the country is in a considerable degree of inhabitants, and therefore its greatest need is that of a body of population. Mark Twain said one may ride 10 miles hereabouts and not see 10 human beings. Mark Twain says further that Palestine sits in sackcloth and ashes, desolate and unlovely. Now, it is important to note the status of the land by observers, because the Arab will all of a sudden claim that it's very important. If this is important land to the Arabs, it is strange that they have ignored it so uniformly and for so long. And as we uncover these kind of realities, it will be important to remember the treatment the land had received at the hands of the Arabs and later the Turks from 1450. Therefore, the Arab in the cry for a restoration of the land to rightful people, one is reminded of the two women who argued over one body in the days of King Solomon. It was the real mother, the owner, who would not let it be divided. So here, the Jews, as we have seen, have taken care of the land as if it were their own. This has never been the case for all the other inhabitants who have lived off the land but never loved the land. At the time of the declaration, the British declaration to Balfour, to the Rothschild, 17, at the time of the declaration was published, there were between 85,000 to 100,000 Jews living in Palestine out of the total population of 600,000. Now, we see a picture here of Jerusalem. Some of us have been there, walked on that wall. We're looking at the southwest corner of Jerusalem, and the curve in the wall is where the Jaffa Gate occurs. And the valley off to the left is the Hinnom Valley, and to the left is where the landmark of the Dutch windmill is, and to the right will be the Temple Mount, and further to the right would be the Mount of Olives. And we see far into the distance just bare open field, and even within the city, within city walls, there's undeveloped land. There could have been a few Arabs that were permanent or long-time dwellers. However, since much of the land was owned by absentee landowners, the people lived as mobile Bedouins, Arabs of various national origins. As we have said, this was open range. Much of it is government owned, and the people come and went as they wanted, as they had for centuries. Somewhere I noticed that even the Valley of Megiddo, the land largely was owned by two absentee landlords. So we have a Bedouin encampment on Suleiman Street near the Damascus Gate in late 1800s. Again, people come and went where they were. There were no attachments to any land, no roots driven down, no permanent dwelling places, or very few. Another picture of about 1850, there never was a homogeneous people. Many were Bedouins who came and went without any attachment to the land. The dark secret is that there really were no real indigenous people. The earliest population estimates, 1882, 1895, although approximate, are important to gauge, important as a gauge to view the impact that the Jewish settlement had upon the population growth in Western Palestine as a whole from the beginning. Thus, they illustrate clearly the pattern that Arab propaganda has obscured. It was a pattern so clear that it prompted ambiguous and apolitical observations such as the following in 1953 by Dr. Voss, then chairman of the American Christian Palestine Committee. The Arab population of Palestine was small and limited until Jewish settlement restored the barren lands and drew to it, the land, Arabs from neighboring countries. We call that immigration. When organized Jewish colonization began in 1852, there were fewer than 150,000 Arabs in the land. The great majority of Arab population in recent decades was comparatively newcomers, either late immigrants or descendants of persons who had immigrated into Palestine in the last 70 years. So again, we have that underscoring idea that there really are no permanent people in the land. There are people in the land, but they are immigrants or recent immigrants. One of the arguments served today is that the Jews moved in and disposed the Arabs of his land. The previous information shows that this was not the case. Now, we have not time to develop this, but if you have any interest in this, you can research these in the scores of books that are out there. And at some point, I will give you a list of bibliography if you want to do your own personal research. And if there were many Arabs in the land at some point, say 1939, it is easily shown that many of these were immigrants along with the Jews. Therefore, on that basis alone, the Arabs have no better standing than the Jews because they're all are immigrants. Lastly, the immigrating Arabs come to the land not to protest the Jewish immigration as such, but to get the value of meaningful and productive work, which in time Jews provided. This is still the case. Palestinians do not want to live in the West Bank with their countrymen, but they want to settle in Israel, not in the so-called West Bank, because the opportunities are there. Something is very often not mentioned. Now, in the Treaty of Versailles, built on the San Marino's division of the land, it set the borders for the Jewish land. This is recognized as international law. The British and the League of Nations had no authority to divide or give 75% of the territory to the Arab Sharif al-Hussein. The British had no obligation to make this concession. Further, there was no consultation with the Jewish leaders. It was just unilaterally done, really for what appears to be no reason. So the Arab Sharif Hussein did accept the division of the and assented to Jews having 25% of the land, which is never talked about either. A little bit more of that in a minute. But how did England lose control of the mandated land? But in a strange move, the British government apparently felt the need to assuage the Emir Abdullah's feelings. Now, keep these names straight. We have a father and two sons. Abdullah is one son. He will eventually be the Prince of Jordan and was assassinated on the steps in the Temple Mount. And it would be his brother, Faisal, which we saw earlier, supposedly fighting with Allenby to take the Arab land from the Ottomans. So this is Abdullah, one of the sons. As one of the royal sons of Hejaz, Saudi Arabia, Abdullah was the recipient of British gratitude That's an understatement. The Arabians of the Hejaz had been among the Arab world of singular assistance to England against the Turks. Now, that is how it has been promoted, that these Arabs are a great help in conquering this territory. But if we leave between the lines, and if you read the book, The No Peace Like No Peace, you'll find that this has been overblown, and there's been a fictitious a narrative been developed that has become history, which is really quite wrong. This is Fromkin's book, See a Peace to End All Peace, where Lloyd George exaggerated greatly the Faisal's contribution to this conquest. And Allenby was the British general who led the way. And remember, Faisal got to Damascus 3 days late, and because he was late and somebody else had actually taken the city without a shot, been welcomed by the leadership of the city, he asked that there would be a demonstration or a reenactment of the conquest with he being the conqueror, and they obliged. Some of these things really seem strange, but become somewhat facts of history that people now build on. Anyway, all fictitious. So the quitclaim deed of 25% of the Mandate territory is the issue. Illegally, the insertion of Abdullah in his emirate into Mandate Palestine in the area east of the Jordan River that was part of the land allocated to the Jews' national homeland, this concession might be partially traced, to a suggestion received by Winston Churchill from Lawrence of Arabia, T.E. Lawrence. In a letter, January 1921, Lawrence informed Churchill that Emir Faisal, brother to Abdullah, just met him, had agreed to abandon all claim to his father's, all claim of his father to the Western Palestine if Faisal got in return Iraq and Eastern Palestine as Arab territories. And that's exactly what was given to them. Now, if the Arabs do not recognize the international law regarding the mandated territories coming out of the San Ramos and will be agreed to by the League of Nations, then they must recognize that the Brits went out of their way to grant territories to the Arab that they had no authority to offer. However, it was offered to the Hussein family, and their designate, Faisal, accepts the land of Iraq and 75% of the mandated territory as Arab territory, and he will not protest that as he cedes the 25% of the mandate given to the Jews. Now, considering all the territories that have been given to the Arabs, Lord Balfour hoped that the small notch of Palestine east and west of the Jordan River, which was being given to the Jewish people, would not be begrudged to them by the Arab leaders. So it's almost like, why is this apology over something they were not supposed to do? Balfour thinks perhaps the Arabs might be unhappy they didn't get all the land, but none of the land was meant to be given to the Arabs. It was supposed to be given to the Jew as their homeland, and he even wrote the letter that said that. Some of this is beyond credulity, I guess. Why is it, might ask this at the end, but why is it that the Arab can never make his own way? Is it fostered in Islamic thinking that he must be taken care of, doesn't stick his neck out, never ventures, never any courage? Why is Balfour so apologetic when giving 75% of the Jewish land to the Arabs when the Brits owned the Arabs nothing? The word there is owed the Arabs nothing. The Arabs should have recognized that they were better off now and be ready with gifts of appreciation to the British rather than leave the impression that the Arabs might be offended. That climate still exists today, and I say, explain that to me if you can. So Arab rights, international law is against them, but the Arab wins. The British mandate is against them, the Arab wins. The British get 75% of the land, which is legal, the Arabs wins. The British hope that they will not be begrudged for giving a small notch of the land to the Jews, and the Arabs win. Now add that, now that they were not indigenous people either. Many of them were immigrants along with the Jews, and again the Arabs win. And lastly, the Arabs gave away their claim to 25% of the land left the Jews when they accepted 75% meant for the Jews, and they still are claiming it's theirs, and the Arabs supposedly wins. So the British apologized for not giving it all away. The British administered the mandate poorly, ignorantly, and cruelly on the Jews. Now, there were times when they beat up on the Arabs as well. There were not enough Arab people for the land to prosper. So the Arabs are drawn to the land when the Jews provide prosperity. Arab immigration is not counted, never was, and is taking away space from the Jewish quotas, which are not even all met. No one counts illegal Arab immigration, and I ask the question again, why not? Because it wasn't required. It was just assumed there'd just be a few there. But in the end, there were a lot there because they came in. The Arabs are victims, they think, yet they have the advantages. The Arabs have one more weapon, and that is riots and terrorism. It's a couple picture of later violence, probably more than the 48 period, but remind that this land is marked with violence, and the pictures of violence are readily available on the internet. And we have our outlines set out for us. We've been in the section from 1850 up through 1920, especially we're now moving past the 1920. We'll end the 1920 riots, 1921, and we have the rest of it up to the 1973 Yom Kippur War, which maybe will even go on into Oslo Peace Accords in 1982. Anyway, that's our track for the rest of our time this year. Well, there's never been a war won by terrorism, and we are interestingly in a time of our life history where terrorism is on every newspaper front page, but it never wins a war. It just causes people to be discouraged and have their lives disrupted. So the Jews were granted privilege under the Ottoman rule, but that effort was an ironic exercise in futility, and we see a picture of Arabs sniping Jewish neighborhood in Jerusalem in the bottom. The Jews were being joined by very poor immigrants. So what few Jews that were there are being joined by other Jews, but they're not rich people. They are very, very poor immigrants because of the pogroms in Russia after 1881 and other times. The condition of extreme poverty and health concerns, plus the lack of civil protection by the government, made life of the Jews nearly impossible. Yet the Jews were seen as the way out of Arab poverty for the local peoples as well as by the English. They said wealth, industry, creativeness would greatly help the progress of civilization. Then why don't we let those people in? Well, in the decades, 1848 to 1878, scores of incidents occurred, minor might call them, almost sometimes between families or small groups of people, of anti-Jewish violence, persecution, extortion, filling page and page after page. This is from Joan Peters' Time Immemorial book. Filling page after page of documentation from British consulate in Jerusalem. Your chronology would be overwhelming, but the pattern of terror continued right into the period of the major Jewish immigration of about 1878. So the land has always had that as their history. The traditional contemptuous fraternity illustrates what measure of credibility may be given to modern promises concerning a Palestinian Arab state, which would value people independent of race and religion. It doesn't exist. There's no Arab state that would value people independent of their race or religion. That was a hope. Over the decades, as the 19th century Dhimini, which is the Jews living in the land, Dhimini are the people that live in Arab territory or Muslim territory that are not Muslim. Sometimes they're tolerated, sometimes they're not. So over the decades, as in the 19th century, the Jews were reinforced, the status of the Jews was reinforced by successive waves of Jewish pioneers, and anti-Jewish violence erupted spasmodically in the Holy Land. Observers label these breaks as European anti-Semitism, Ottomanism, and later anti-Zionism. British officials attribute the violence or disturbances to the manifestation of Arab nationalism, the idea that the only reason these conflicts are going on is because the Arabs want their own state. However, British, however, were never able to discover in their investigation any manifestation of such nationalism on the part of the Arabs in Palestine other than the oppression and intolerance shown toward the Dhimmi, which are the people that live within Muslims that are not Muslims. This narrowly based nationalism of violence continued to grow as the Jews continued to struggle out of Dhimmi status towards freedom and equality. Now, the Arab have always said they wanted a national state, but I always wondered why in the world, in 1948, when they had the opportunity to establish an Arab state, they didn't for 19 years till 1967, when the place for an Arab state could have been established was taken from them in war because of their aggression. Israel took back the West Bank. But there was no Palestinian state for 19 years. So you wonder whether they really want a Palestinian state after all, and that's what the point is here. The British investigators were eventually forced to concede and officially to note that Arab nationalism in Palestine had been artificially pumped up. Only a little firmness is needed to deflate it, unlike the insurgent nationalism elsewhere. So you want to compare the idea of a national state for the Palestinians and ones that were looking for their own independence, like in India and these countries in Africa, they were not really comparable. In Palestine, Arab nationalism is inextricably interwoven with the antagonism to the Jews, which is the key issue. Nothing to do with the nationalism. Still is today. Even though they talk about a two-state solution, it makes no solution at all. Yet, by so perverse a rationale, was a movement of enmity dignified, and the legend of Palestinian nationalism initiated. So we have good things happening for the Jews in the land. The Hebrew University is established. Interesting that they, one of the first things they do, even before there's a government, they establish a place of education. The last Zionist conference occurred in this approximate time before World War I, and we have protesting Jewish immigration that continually went on, and the British military control from November 1918 and until the mandate took over, and we'll have the civil minister of Jerusalem. And then we have the beginning of the Israeli self-defense. Later it will be called the Haganah. We have the picture here of Jaffa Gate. And again, to the right, we have the Hinnon Valley. And it goes off down to the south towards the Dead Sea, where before it gets to the Dead Sea, it joins up with the Kidron Valley on the left. So some of you have been there. You see how it looks then. Well, the problems of the Middle East are easily summarized as simply the Jews want back into the land and the Arabs do not want the Jews there. That's basically it. The rest are details, sometimes interesting details, but that is it. And we know the outcome is settled. The Jews will be back in the land. It will cost them dearly, different generations. Many people will die. But in the end, they will be back in their land. And in the end, they will be back in the land as obedient people, which is yet future. So they're coming back to land in the dry bone stage, I think, of Ezekiel 36-37. Okay, the details that the pressure on the Jews to return grows as they return, the Arab population benefits, but in spite of the advantages of the Jews coming back to the land, they resist this Jewish immigration. It's kind of like biting the hand that feeds you. The British are given a mandate to provide homeland space, but are unable to carry it out, being at one time sympathetic to the Arab and at other times faithful to the mandated duties. As the British struggle to keep the Jews as benefactors of the mandate, they fail to give away precious land meant for the Jews. We just went through that. Then when the Jews are threatened by Arab riots, the British are unprepared and appease the Arabs rather than defend the Jewish their Jewish charge. As the British fail their duties, the Jews find a way to provide security that does not depend on the British. They begin to form self-defense organizations against the grain of the British leadership. This pattern continues throughout the mandated period. It would have been easier, think about it, it would have been easier if the British dealt with a few protesting Arabs, there were only a few that had long-term attachments, and helped the Jews in the land, at the very least, allowed the Jews to have self-defense. In the end, the adjustment would have been over in a few years. However, appeasement only puts off the inevitable conflict, which came in 1948. Yet, by divine will, the result was a recovery of some of the 25% of the land by the national law from the belligerent Arab nations. Remember, the United Nations took away even more of the land. Well, in 1940 to 1967, they got all of it back. So we have it being taken away again and again and again, and we find how we wonder how small the land will the Arab be satisfied with that the Jew can own, and the answer to that is none of it. So whatever the Jews give away, there will never be an acceptance of that on the Arab part. Talk about self-defense in Haganah. We have a Jabotinsky who was fought with the British and was part of the liberating force with Allenby. And so he's trained in the British military, and he becomes a Zionist and becomes a well-spoken, very influential, highly respected leader. And he forms the self-defense, some might call the civilian self-defense of the Jews. And this is a little difficult to figure out how all this happens, so I'm going to do my best with this and hope it makes some sense for you. Prior to the Kislev, which is in Ukraine, where he came from, pogroms of 1903, Jabotinsky joined the Zionist movement, where he soon became known as a powerful speaker and an influential leader. With more pogroms looming on the horizon, he established the Jewish Self-Defense Organization, a Jewish militant group to safeguard Jewish communities throughout Russia. Now he's going to apply it to Israel. The British military administration of Palestine was criticized for withdrawing troops from within of Jerusalem, and thus it was slow to regain control. As a result, the riots, trust between the British and the Jews and the Arabs was eroded. Britain ends up being some an obstacle for all sides. One consequence was that the Jewish community increased moves towards an autonomous infrastructure, and they're starting to establish things that governments do. Security apparatus parallel to that of the British administration. Now we have the self-defense begins. We're anticipating the privilege of the mandate, but even before that, we have violence break out. After violence broke out in 1920 in Jerusalem, Jabotinsky met military governor Storrs and suggested deployment of his volunteers, but his request was rejected by the British. Storrs confiscated his pistol and demanded to know the location of his weapons, threatening to arrest him for possessing a firearm. Later, Storrs changed his mind and asked for 200 volunteers to report to the police headquarters to be sworn in as deputies. Well, that didn't last long. After they arrived and administering the oath and begun, orders came to cease or to stop, and he sent them away. Air volunteers had also been invited. They were likewise sent away. It seemed like you can't just have one side in charge. You always have to have both. You can't have both. You send them both away. It is evident that the British are not prepared to defend the mandates, largely due to their unwillingness to stand against the Arabs. So we have a couple of riots. A 1920 riot predates the mandate just a few months. In 1920, the Nebi Musa, that's the Prophet Moses, riots in Jerusalem, took place in the British-controlled territory. in April 1920 and around the Old City. And a member of the San Rainbow Conference that set the boundaries for the land was in April, early April of that year, or later April in that year. This riot was the beginning of April of that year. The slogans were used inside the riots, referenced Zion immigration and previous confrontations around outlying Jerusalem villages in the Galilee. Speeches by Arab religious leaders during the festival led to violent assaults on Jews in the city. 5 Jews and 4 Arabs were killed. Several hundred were injured. Now, after the riots, the British arrested the Arabs, both Arab and Jewish leaders. Among those arrested was Jabotinsky, together with 19 of his associates on a charge of illegal possession of weapons. Jabotinsky was sentenced to 15 years imprisonment with hard labor and deportation from the country after the completion of his sentence. Well, with the arrival in Jerusalem of the first high commissioner, Herbert Samuel, I couldn't remember his name before, Sir Herbert Samuel, British military government was superseded by the civilian administration. Well, he, in a gesture toward the civilian population, the high commissioner proclaimed a general amnesty for both the Jews and Arabs who had been involved in the April 1920 riots. Let them go. Now, just one panel here to say it. All the Arabs were not against the Jews. In its wake, the sheikhs of 82 villages around the city of Jerusalem and Jaffa, claiming to represent 70% of the population, issued a document protesting demonstration against the Jews. This condemnation may have been procured by bribes, so they say, but on the other hand, it may have been genuine. Notwithstanding the riots, the Palestinian Jewish community held elections for the Assembly of Representatives. So wherever you see the Jews have an opportunity to organize, they organize themselves in a civil manner. And that will work, and that will continue on until the time when they declare themselves state, because they have all these organizational, these infrastructure committees and groups already in a place, even their military. Well, the riots preceded the San Rainbow Conference, which was held in late in April. I mentioned that before. Now, I said this, I think it was our last lesson, talk about violence had been suggested by the British Army Chief of Staff. His name was Waters Taylor. It was asserted by wise men and British Army Meinertzhagen, try to say that, the Haj Amin al-Husseini, uncle of Musha, and got 2 guys to keep track of here. We have Husha and Musha, M-U-S-H, meaning like Moses, I guess, and Amin are 2. Amin is the younger one, the Musa is the older one. Okay, it was asserted by wise men in British Army Meinertzhagen that Haj Amin al-Husseini had been put up to inciting the riot by British Field Marshal Allenby's Chief of Staff, Waters Taylor, to demonstrate to the world that the Arabs would not tolerate a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Remember, he made this little frame, it says that freedom could only be attained through violence. So there are those Jews, at least, that believe that a lot of this violence was instigated by the Arab, British, using the Arabs as a tool, because the British themselves were Arabist, you might call them. Well, as Amin, the younger one, had taken the colonel's advice and instigated a riot, the British withdrew their troops and the Jewish police from Jerusalem, and the Arab mob attacked the Jews, looted their shops. Due to Amin's overt role in instigating the pogrom, the British arrested him. Yet despite the arrest, Amin escaped to Jordan. What would you guess? But he was sentenced to 10 years imprisonment in absentia. Now get this. A year later, however, British Arabists, those that would support the Arab side, convinced High Commissioner Jewish Herbert Samuel to pardon Amin and to appoint him as Mufti of Jerusalem. Can you imagine that? Well, his uncle apparently just been relieved of his duty, so it goes. Samuel met with Amin on April 11, 1921, and was assured that the influences of his family and himself would be devoted to tranquility. And you can fill in the blanks. 3 weeks later, however, riots in Jaffa and another Jewish settlement instigated by the Mufti left 43 Jews dead. One more riot. This one in Jaffa a year later. The Jaffa riots was a series of violent riots in the Mandatory Palestine, which began as a fight between two Jewish groups being developed into an attack by Arabs. I think the Arabs first took one side against the Jews and against the other group, but in the end they end up being attacked by the Arabs. Now, the riot began in Jaffa and spread to other parts of the country. Now, the riot resulted in 47 Jews and 48 Arabs dead, so on and so forth. Now, on the night of May 1921, the Jewish Communist Party called for the toppling of British rule and establishing of the Soviet Palestine. Remember, the Russian Revolution was 1917, and their ideology spread like wildfire, and there were many of those Jews, remember, lived in Russia, Prussia, you know, remember the borders changed. So they had some influence from communists, and so the Jews had a communist element in them. It never was dominant. It was always minority, and it was a cause of this riot, and that ended up being a riot where many were killed and the Arabs turned on the Jews. So the High Commissioner Herbert Samuel declared a state of emergency, imposed press censorship, and called for reinforcements from Egypt and so forth. Well, Uncle Musa al-Hassini, who had been dismissed as Jerusalem's mayor on account of his involvement in the previous year's Nebi Musa riots, demanded a suspension of Jewish immigration. And, you know, it's one of those kind of things that happen again and again. Arabs can come in, but Jews can't come in. And the thing of it is, Samuel assented, and two or three small boats holding 300 Jews were refused permission to land and were forced to return to Istanbul. I don't show you a picture of that. I just show you the harbor. At the same time, al-Husseini's nephew, Amin al-Husseini, was appointed Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, a decision that later faced much criticism. So we just have things that happen that just seem like are the wrong things to happen if you're going to keep peace in the country. So the British make their mistake, and we have, besides just being making mistakes, they have this internal division in the British government. Some are pro-Israel, no doubt the Christian element of it, and then we have those that are pro-Arab, no doubt those that are unbelievers in it because they always promote the wrong side. So we have that as the beginning of the riots. We have a section to go up through World War II left for next time, and at that time, we'll have our break for the seasons that come up, Christmas and New Year's, and we'll pick it up back in January. So there's one more lesson that will deal with violence in the leading up to the national statehood of Israel.